Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. It is time once again. Hey, what happened there? Once again, for America's Most Haunted Radio, I am extremely excited because we have with us this evening Brian Higgins. We were just chatting away here. That's what kind of caught me off guard. And he's the director and producer of award, and the star, for that matter, of the award-winning Haunting documentary. And we're not talking haunting in the sense of, oh, it stuck with me. No, we're talking literal haunting, The Castle Project. And it is an amazing, amazing thing. We were just discussing it, in fact. Background on the film is this. Brian, who is both a filmmaker, obviously, if he wasn't before, he is now, and an architect, and he takes on the project of renovating the historic Croke Patterson Mansion, which really does look like a castle, in Denver. And all kinds of interesting, wild things happen. He does great work, research into the history of the place. We're seeing kind of real time as things, as the renovation unfolds. Plus, we're seeing kind of in inevitable comparison, Paranormal Activity fashion, we're seeing a camera that's on him, and we're seeing the result of what happens with that on many evenings as he actually stays in the house while the renovation is taking place. All kinds of strange and interesting things happen. There are sessions with ghost hunters, and on and on and on. And then at the end, and as our regular listeners know, I am nothing if not a procrastinator. I am watching the film here. I have like 5 minutes to go. I missed the very end. This is the closest I've pretty much ever got to the end of a movie. Now, I usually say, hey, I never watch the whole movie or read the whole book before I do the interview because I don't want to give anything away. And that's somewhat true, or at least partially true, but it's also usually that I run out of time. Anyway, at the very end, and I don't want to give it away, but real interesting kind of right turn that kind of comes out of nowhere. I assume it derives somewhat from Brian's architectural background that he would notice such things. But I'm not going to give that away. We will certainly talk about it. Kind of that final proposition and theory that happens at the end of the film. And incidentally, it is available in various formats, including DVD, which is how I watched it, and it looks really good. It's very well put together. And I'll tell you what, this is a fascinating documentary. Welcome to the program, Brian Higgins.
Well, thanks, Eric. Thanks for bringing us on here and getting to check out the film for us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Teresa, are you with us?
I'm here. Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Teresa. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really, really enjoyed the film, and I can't wait to get into some talk about it. Fascinating place.
Absolutely. It definitely is fascinating, even after having it for a few years now.
All right, for those who don't know, Teresa is in fact the world-famous haunted housewife. So it is so great, actually, on the show to be back into what is really our wheelhouse. You know, we go off in so many different directions, cryptozoology, horror films and TV, UFOs, and on and on and on. But ultimately, ghosts are what we are all about, being America's Most Haunted. So this is great. This is some meaty, meaty stuff for us. Teresa, since you are, in fact, the world-famous haunted housewife, would you like to begin a discussion?
Absolutely. Brian, I was real fascinated when I heard about the Castle Project, and it's something that I've heard about for a while, but to actually get to see the film, and I know that there are people out there that probably have heard rumors about it or bits and pieces about it. Maybe they haven't seen the whole film, but the history behind this castle, and I want you to get into it a little bit and tell us about the Croke Patterson family and this building, this mansion that they built, and how it came into your possession. And then we'll get into the film and the actual hauntings, because I tell you, this kind of place is right up my alley. like to
very good. Well, you know, I think it's the history is 120 years, and I'm just a small part of it. But it's a place that I've never been able to find a place like this, and there's only a few I think that exist in the world. So the way it started was the gentleman who decided to build the house was Thomas Croak. And back in late 1800s, he decided that he would build this monstrosity of a chateau-esque architecture style home, and he built it. And there's some folklore, but I think the dates are that he finished the house and he owned it for 6 months, and then he ended up just deciding it wasn't for him. And there's various reasons. I think his mother died during the construction, and he ended up just kind of being all alone, and so he decided that he was going to get rid of it. Folklore says that he walked into the house, and he took one look, and he said, "This place is haunted, and I am not living here." So it would have been 6 months from the time that he finished it to the time he sold it, and he ended up not selling it, but he ended up trading it to Thomas Patterson, who was soon to be Senator of Colorado at the time. And so we traded it to the Patterson family for some land, some farmland, out in kind of the outskirts of Denver suburbs. And so that family took it on, and they lived there for 30-some years, 35 years. And as of, they had 7 children that were born, and only one lived to adulthood. So that's kind of eerie. After that, it went from various things from a single-family home to a radio station to an apartment building to office building, back to single-family home, and then I got it in 2011. And it had been vacant for 3 years prior to that.
And now,
Brian, side note here. Excuse me one sec. I just want to interject. Speaking of radio station in a castle, how cool is this? I went to a small liberal arts school in Springfield, Ohio, called Wittenberg University. And at that time, which is not recent, the school radio station was in the basement of a dorm room that looked exactly like a castle. So that was always the running joke is you know, this modern technology, our school radio station was in the dungeon, literally the dungeon of this ancient, I don't know how old the building really was, I think they've ended up tearing it down, but this ancient building that everyone thought of as a castle. Carry on, had to interject.
Very good. Well, you know, I think that it's been so many things because it's had such a hard time being successful at what it was intended to be. A radio station was there briefly. Usually I would think radio stations would be somewhere where no one would see anything, like, you know, a face for radio, a room for radio. But apparently it was the radio station was, I think, in the 1930s, and then it kept switching over to all these different uses, and nothing was very successful. And you know, you can think about why it wasn't successful or who was in charge of the house at the time, but it just wasn't working for most. The last gent that lived there since 1998 to 2008, he was doing fine, and he ended up losing the house for strange reasons. But it sat vacant in the bank's hands for 3 years, and then I took the plunge and decided it needed to be a bed and breakfast. And so that's
now,
what it is.
What
now
is your background, personally, though, leading up to that?
Well, I have no knowledge in paranormal research, I can tell you that. And I come from engineering and architecture, and I take old buildings and renovate them into a new use or fix up, you know, what used to be a problem, figure out the zoning and blah, blah, blah. But I find troubled buildings, and I give them a new use, and then hopefully they do well.
Brian, when you came across the property, where is it located? I mean, is it in a very residential area? It seems like such a monstrosity of a building. What is around there, and what was around there when Croak built this place? Was it in a very busy part of town, or was it kind of off to the side? Or it just seems so odd that it would be a residential place, or were there other large houses out there?
That's a great question, and I think it goes back to the origin of Denver. You know, in Denver, we're young. We're only 150 years old. But the center city of Denver started, and it was the old Western look, and it kind of migrated out a bit. In the late 1800s, 1890s, the silver mining took off, and all of a sudden everybody had some money, or a few people had some money, I should say. And they ended up building on Capitol Hill. And so this place is near the Capitol of Denver, and it used to be amongst many other mansions of 14 to 20,000 square feet. And over the last 100 years, they've been demolished into apartment buildings, and it's a mixed breed between mansions and kind of the end of the glorious age of Denver from the late 1800s to apartments mixed in and parking problems, and it's a very bizarre but happening place.
And the mansion was actually, the stone that built the mansion was taken from a very famous place and tell us a little bit about the origin of the actual stone that built the mansion, because that plays a lot into the film and into some of the superstitions and possible reasons behind the haunting. And I found that was extremely interesting, especially toward the end of the film when you're comparing the famous paintings and the background.
The symbolism, it's an interesting part because there was a quarry that was open, and it's about 100 miles south of Denver, give or take, and they quarried this sandstone that was very soft, and it's red. And, you know, as an architect, I look back, and as the Monday morning quarterback, I'm thinking, well, you know, this sandstone is so soft, why would you build a building out of it? Because it's not going to last. They put in so much effort into the detailing and carvings of it, and it's sculpted in various places in Denver. And as the years took on, it kind of the rain, which we don't get very much of, but it does wash the detail away. And so it's a very poor building material. And I would say that there's a place, you know, not too far away from the quarry, literally a 9-iron away, where it's these big rocks and there are these sandstone formations that just protrude out of the ground a couple hundred feet, and climbers go there to scale the thing. It's called Garden of the Gods, and it's a beautiful place for sure, but they decided after, you know, 3 or 4 years that the quarry would then be closed down and no one would be able to mine any of this stone. There's a lot of history that goes along with this place called the Garden of the Gods, and, you know, some of it's Native American. You can't quantitate any issues with the stone as far as paranormal, but you can definitely think about how this place unfolded. And there's various other houses in Denver that have the stone as the exterior, and they are known to have some paranormal issues as well.
That's fascinating. I don't want to give too much away because I want people to see this film, but that's just one of the spooky elements that are, and this is just history. This isn't even getting into the ghost stories. This is just some of the very kind of spooky things surrounding the mansion. And the other thing is the entire neighborhood, the Capitol Hill neighborhood, and some of the things that went on when they were building and digging and things that they found when they were moving things around.
Mm-hmm. The area has been transformed a few times, but there used to be what was known as the City Ditch, and it was the water irrigation canal for the city of Denver, and it literally ran right between the carriage house and the main house, which I thought was interesting. And what I found, and this is not in the movie, but what I found between the carriage house and the main house was an old well underneath, kind of in a dark, dungy area, crawl space, and it's an existing well that went down and picked up water from this water source that used to be there. It's since been built over with many, many layers.
It's excellent. Eric, you want to jump in here? Because I'll keep going if you don't stop me.
Haunted Housewife sounds kind of like a naughty title, doesn't it?
Well, it can be. It depends on the day of the week, I guess. But
for sure.
Yeah, there's several directions and topics that we would love to cover. I'm interested, very interested in, again, without, of course, the caveat, we don't want to give away too much, but just let the listeners know kind of what the key paranormal aspects are that are detailed and often shown outright in the film, and or anything that kind of got left out. The part, what I really like maybe best about the whole thing, which perhaps will sound odd, is in some of the really quiet moments. Like, I love the scene where you're sitting down there in the basement and you're sitting by that hole. I don't know, is that a fireplace? Whatever that is, that hole in the wall.
I'll have to describe that for you.
Please do. And you're smart enough, or you trust yourself or the subject matter enough that you really kind of let it run quite a while, and there's not that much happening, at least at first. Then you're hearing what seem to be steps up above, and all we're seeing, it's this very intimate moment where you're kind of just musing with yourself, and it feels really human to me. It feels really real. Here's a normal guy, smart guy. Obviously, you've been successful to whatever extent with your professional life that you're in a position to do this in the first place. And yet you are letting us see that, wow, you know, this is really, really a creepy place. I'm going to try to not let it get to me, but oh no, it's getting to me. And just to see that unfold, I think, is really insightful and was a genius move on your part, and very, you allowed yourself to be very vulnerable, and I really like that.
You know, when you get and you get a camera and you're the only one in the room, you know, the camera is your only friend in the room, I would say. And down in this room, it's in the basement of the Croke Patterson Mansion. There's an old foundation chimney that comes down, and there's a hole in it. And the hole was from, there was a psychic in the 1970s that had said there's a baby buried in the basement, and the owner, who I talked to, he did not believe that there was, in fact, a baby in the basement, or didn't believe in ghosts and didn't believe in psychics. But it ended up freaking him out to the point where he hired a group of people to go in there and take a sledgehammer and and breaking into the brick wall to see what was in this void. They broke through the concrete and they ended up tearing up much of the basement to find this baby that was buried. Well, they didn't find anything, but they ended up leaving holes in various places. And this has been 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So this hole is one of the relics of the house, and it's one of the most eerie parts of the house. So I'm sitting next to it, and you know, I'm not very theatrical. I'm an engineer, you know, so we just believe in what we see and what makes sense. But I'm down there and I'm describing this hole that's in the concrete wall, and you know, all of a sudden I'm hearing things above me, and it sounds like footsteps, and I can't believe that that's happening, and I'm not so sure about myself. But what you see in the movie is pure terror, and I was scared for my life. It was probably one of the most frightening times of my life. And then after I'm hearing this, I take the camera upstairs, and I'm not going to give it away, but it's the closest I've come to having the hands-on experience with a ghost that I've ever even dreamed of.
It's a great scene. It's a great part of the movie. As Therese was saying, I like very much the historical part. It seems to just flow really well, the way you put it together. It really seems to fit. Do you have a filmmaking background, or is this just out of the blue?
Marginal. My brother and I, we got into filmmaking maybe 6 years ago, so we're pretty new, and we've started to do some television for some local stations in Denver. But when I did see the house, and I knew I was going to fix it, I felt like I was chosen, or something brought me to the house, because the house needed me to fix the rundown disaster that it was into something that's usable. And so when I stumbled across this thing, I decided, you know, this needs to be a documentary. And it's not a horror movie, it's a documentary. And I went in with that intention. So everything you see in the film is, in fact, what happened. You know, there's no actors. This isn't the fake Paranormal Activity version, which I did enjoy. But, you know, everything happened as it did, and I let it be honest. And I think that's the appeal of the movie.
Yes, absolutely. Of the experiences, what was the very, very first inkling that you personally got, not as told by others, because you do a very good job of putting mm-hmm. together that as well, the background on the place and interviews with previous owners and whatnot, but what was your very, very first experience that told you personally, within yourself, hey, wow, there may be something going on here?
That's a good question. The first experience led to many, 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 many other experiences. The first time I was ever in the house, it was for sale, and I was in there with one other person just checking it out and seeing if I was interested in doing this project. And I'm in the courtyard, and it feels like a vortex. There's just nothing going on, and to a point where it's eerie. And I'm looking around, and I just had hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I'm looking around, and it just felt like someone was in there in this courtyard between the carriage house and the main house with me, even though no one was. And then I go up to the third floor, and as I'm going up the third floor, I hear this knock right next to my head on the wall. And, you know, I'm behind the person that's with me, Elizabeth. She's in the film, but she's at the top of the stairs, and I hear this knock right next to my head. And that was just the beginning of all these occurrences. After 18 months of filming, and I've since had it for another year, the occurrences happen so often for me that it's not scary, because it just occurs so frequently. There's strange noises. There's things that you put in one place and they get moved to another. There's stories from various people that are in the place. The contractors had all kinds of stories that you know, they'd take down a wall and there would be this strange odor of death when nothing was in the wall. And so I'm not frightened by it anymore, but I just expect it, and the house is kind of a friend of mine, I guess, is a weird way to put it.
I got to tell you, Brian, you're the one contractor that's very prominent in the movie that tells a lot of the stories and the things that are happening. He's a scary-looking dude. He looks like he's ready for his own reality show. But he had some interesting stories about things that were that they were experiencing, these contractors and the people that were working on it. What I really liked about the movie was you went into the history. You gave a lot of the background. I mean, down to the stone that the building was built on. I mean, the Garden of the Gods and the history behind that, even so much as going to the Garden of the Gods and showing that, going eventually to Italy and that whole part that comes later in the end. But the interviews you did with the former residents, the people who lived there, the people who worked on it, and then getting into the history, because some of those former owners, they really had some interesting stories to tell. And I like how that was balanced with just the paranormal, when you bring in the paranormal team and they're doing their thing, because that really, I mean, and I'm a paranormal investigator. I know it gets really hokey sometimes. That's why I like to come at it from the historical point of view. But I really love the deep history, the documents. The one owner, and I wish I her name escapes me, but with the jars that she found in the basement. I mean,
oh, yes.
I was trying to think if you can pinpoint one thing of why you think this place is so haunted, but there's so many elements in it. But I love the free part of it.
I would say I can't tell you why it's haunted. I mean, there's so many things and there's so many parts to this book, right? But what I do know is that as soon as I was able to get this with my partner Travis, who was in the show, everyone came out of the woodwork. Owners from 1978, owners from 1972. Mary Ray is the one who saved the building from getting torn down and turned into a parking lot. She loved the building in 1972. She decided that the building needed to stay, so she went and got landmark certification. And once that occurs, then it's protected. And so that was Mary Ray that was the one you were referring to. Then owners were calling me on a Monday morning at 8:30 that, you know, owners from 1978 that had amazing stories. Melody Crawford lived there for a number of years in the last decade, and she's had stories where, you know, she has been helped. You know, she was pregnant with triplets in her bed, and she was just so enormous that she couldn't move over, and all of a sudden someone appeared, and she believes it to be one of the former residents that kind of looked up and said, "You need help, I will help you roll over," and that's what happened. And Melody, you know, she felt like she felt at ease and she felt calming from this person, but there was not a living soul in the room when this occurred. So when word got out, or I don't know how it happened, but all these people found me, and it's kind of been a community of different individuals that have owned it for the last 40 years.
Which of the owners had interesting stories? I mean, they all seem to have a story, but who lived there the longest and who seemed to experience the most paranormal activity? Was this when it was a private residence, or was it, what era of the mansion, of the building, seemed to have the most paranormal activity from what you found in your research?
Okay. As far as paranormal as we know it in modern day, and we can account for their stories, the more recent ones are more paranormal. The earlier ones seem to be the causes of the paranormal. So when you have someone in the 1950s commit suicide, and the legend has it that, you know, their baby was buried in the basement, that all led up to the last 30 years, where I would say it's been the majority of the accounts. From 1998 to 2008 was the only time it's been a single-family residence in the last 100 years. So I think there are quite a few stories that go along with that decade because they're there at night. Prior to that, it's office, and those stories are still there, but it's more, you know, let's say that the copy machine starts to act weird, and I don't know if that's much of a story. But if you're there at night, the stories seem to be better, and I'm guessing that it has something to do with being dark and, you know, scary and all that good stuff.
And you spent a total of how many nights in the mansion when you were filming? Brian, for those of you who haven't seen the film, Brian went in with his camera and spent a number of nights in there just to kind of experience it for himself. And this is documented through the movie of things that happen, the quiet things, the weird things, the unusual things. It's all documented with cameras, stationary cameras, and his handheld cameras, and he tells what's going on. And how many days did you actually stay, and when did you decide, okay, that's enough, I'm done, time to get out?
I was planning on doing a month because it's a good round number, and I think it would take that long to really get to know a place. And I made it, how far did I make it? It must have been about halfway. And through the first 2 weeks, I had some scary things that were happening to me. You know, the one that I talked about before in the basement and coming upstairs to with the video camera. Other things were in the middle of the night, you hear bumps and knocks in the walls, and you hear it repeatedly. And it really wears you out. Now, I could handle that because I know that, you know, I'm not fearing for my life or anything. It was just kind of creepy. What ended up happening over the first 2 weeks was I had some break-ins, numerous break-ins of people, vagabonds, tourists. And, you know, there were broken windows. I woke up one night, or one morning, and I went downstairs, and the window was broken, and someone had been in the house, but I didn't know who or what, or even if they knew I was there. So that's kind of an issue. But the final straw that ended my month-long stay in 2 weeks was the fact that it was a danger to my life. If somebody broke in and the place caught on fire, there was no sprinkler system. There's no fire alarms. The smoke would have overtaken me, and I wouldn't have made it out alive. Being on the third floor, it was a dangerous place, and no one would have known. So I realized that, you know, life safety is important, and I ended my stay. And then several months later, the place ended up burning up from a fire that was spontaneous combustion, is what the fire investigator said.
So really it was your fear of
spontaneous
fear of
combustion.
Ghosts?
Yeah, that means we don't know what the hell happened.
Well, that's what he said, you know, and, you know, that we had contractors in there. There could have been rags, there could have been this, there could have been that, but he didn't know what started the fire, and there was no way to find out, and so that was the official diagnosis.
Now, do you live there now?
I don't live there. I don't live far, but it's an operating bed and breakfast, and Sue, our general manager over there, she lives there full time, and then we have guests coming in every night, and they're the residents now.
So have you ever lived there since then? Excuse me, since those 2 weeks?
You know, I've been back, and I've stayed the night a few times as an innkeeper, and, you know, it's not completely calming, but it's not scary. I know the place, and I know what it's about, and so I'm comfortable there. And most of our guests go there, and they don't know the history, and we've had, we have very few complaints about the place, but we have some people that are going there to see what the house is about, and then we have a lot of Europeans that are coming because they like the castle look, I think. But it's been a year and a half since we opened, and it's been working pretty well.
Teresa, you were talking.
I forgot what I was going to say. When you left, did you really, honestly, was it your fear of fire, or was it just kind of a combination of everything, and then you realized, oh, crap, there's no fire things? I was going to ask you how long the fire till after you left, but you said it was a few months. And they don't think that it was anything that they could attribute to electrical? I mean, I'm just kind of confused at a fire that big, and how much damage was actually done? I mean, did you have to start over from that point, or did...
Start over, no. To answer your first question, I would say that it was a combination of everything, and the final straw was the fire safety. And, you know, with being an architect, I do focus on codes and how the fire can be so dangerous and why sprinkler systems are important. It finally dawned on me that it wasn't a safe place. Now, you also have various break-ins. I had some people on the third floor that I heard, and I came out, and I don't know who was more scared, them or me, but they were tourists, and they were looking to see what the house was about, but they thought I was a troll or something living on the third floor. I have footage of that, but it didn't make it in the movie. So then you get to, you know, what part of it started the fire, and how big was it? And it was big enough to have smoke damage from the second and third floor all the way up, and water damage from the second floor all the way down. So we had to replace the finishes. All the woodwork had to be redone. We had a fire mitigation company come in and neutralize kind of the smell. Everything had to be encapsulated and painted over with shellac and then painted over with paint. It was substantial, and it took, let's see, the fire happened in June, and it took until October 1 for us to open. So it was about... do the math, 5 months of redo. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was heartbreaking. I mean, we'd put our life and soul into this thing, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're starting over again. It was just, it was terrible.
I was in tears watching it. It was so sad to see that happen. I think any historic place, when things like that happen, it's really tragic. When you were staying in the house, your dog, you have your dog with you through the film, and actually animals play into a lot in this film for animal lovers. You might want to brace yourself for this. But your animal, and then you had a friend that stayed with you for a couple nights, and she had her dog. Did the dogs experience anything? Did you notice them acting strangely at any time, things that you maybe didn't notice?
I did, and I'm a huge dog lover. I get dogs, and I understand them, and I think they understand me. And that's what made this makes this story so traumatizing. And this is a story from 1978, when it was being converted from an apartment building to an office building. The owner, he had contractors in there. And they were working, you know, 24 hours a day sometimes, and sometimes they would, you know, leave at midnight. Well, they would come back in the morning, and things would be, and I hate to use the word undone because it sounds silly, but let's say they installed a handrail and, you know, I'm using this as an arbitrary, and some drywall. They'd come back, and it would be taken down. And then they would leave the next day and things would be stolen or moved, or, you know, there were people or something in there that was causing this mischief. And so he ended up putting in a guard dog that was a German Shepherd, long-haired German Shepherd. He said it was about 90 pounds. And he had put it in overnight, and he came back the next morning, and the dog had jumped through a plate glass window on the first floor. Folklore says that the dog jumped out of the third floor, but I got to go with what he told me. And it was they blasted through the window on the first floor, and was so cut up that he had to go to the patio, and he was laying there, and you know, he didn't make it from all the cuts. So, you know, that wasn't a good feeling. The next night he put in a second dog, and they came back the following morning. And this German Shepherd was back in the farthest corner of the basement, and he says that it was catatonic and sitting in a mess of its own feces and urine. So something scared these dogs to the point where they just, you know, they one didn't make it and the other was never the same. And there's no way to find out what that is, but, you know, that's a story, I think, that has been following the house for a long time. And hearing it from the guy that owned the house, he didn't want to be in the film, but his voice is muffled a bit. But, you know, he didn't want to be in it, but this is a story that I got to believe. The woman that we talked about before, Mary Ray, she was a real estate broker at the time, and she had sold it to him. And then she came in, and she can attest to the dogs that were on the dog that was on the patio and the dog that was in the basement. So two different independent parties confirm that.
Well, there's also a scene in the movie itself where we see you're in the it's the sleep cam, the bed cam, and we see the dog poking around, sniffing around. Definitely something's going on. That's kind of a key moment, I think, really. So there's no question about the involvement of both dogs, and then there's some action with cats, or at least former cats.
Ellie was not she was not very comfortable during the stay, and Ellie was a dog that I had. And then Jen came in with her dogs, and her dogs are pacing around the whole night. So there's not a comfort level for canines, which I think they have an extra sense maybe.
Oh, sure. We've talked about that many times, that dogs and, well, not just dogs, but animals and children, young children, just don't seem to have the filters, is one theory. They don't have the filter, not blocking it out, are receptive. In the case of animals, it can simply be that they have different sensory apparatus, basically, so they may be just picking up on things that are outside of our range. What is your sense now after going through that whole experience and now the subsequent couple years, year and a half, you said it's been open. Do you have a sense of an identity to spirits, or is it just kind of this general creepiness stuff happening? I mean, do you have a sense of individuals?
Mm-hmm. There is a very much a sense of individuals, and we've had some investigators in there, several actually. And the overall consensus is that there's in the basement there's this masculine negative spirit that is kind of in charge of the house, and that's the one that causes the trouble. You know, we had an inspector in there, and he heard a door getting broken in half. You know, that angry masculine evil voice, and there's a female voice that comes from the top of the house, and it's led to believe to be Thomas Patterson's daughter. That she was the last, I guess, single family resident of the house before the 2000s. So, you know, that's kind of the calming, reassuring voice that you have in the third floor. So there's this spectrum from top to bottom that it varies. They've captured a lot of different EVPs, and some of them are in the movie. And they are conversations that are occurring between evil voice and sometimes female voice. But there's also a third party in there it's a male voice, but it's resisting the evil one from the basement. I can't tell you who it is as far as those two, but that's the consensus from a couple different investigation groups that have been in there.
What is your current metaphysical view, and has it in fact changed since before this process began?
When it began, I was open to various ideas. I don't have strong faith, but I have intrigue. And so in the beginning, you know, I was very intrigued by what was going on there, and it did lead me on this journey of finding out my own personal beliefs as far as religion, afterlife, and that's kind of the story that's the story I'm bringing you through, and so you'll see how it progresses. But it was the catalyst that sent me on this journey. After the story, you know, after the whole project, you know, I'm a believer in the afterlife. I don't know what it is, but you know, there's some energy at the house that I can't explain, and no one can really explain. But what it did was it sent me on this journey, and now I'm even more eager to find out what's going on than I was in the beginning. And I don't have any answers. I wish I could just say, this is absolute, you know, what happens when you die. But I'm not sure. I'm just more intrigued to find out without going there.
Put that off for a while. Sure.
Exactly.
I agree with you. All right. So what's next? Have you gone back to being a renovator and innkeeper now, or do you have a subsequent film and or paranormal projects either in process or ahead?
I'm not sure what's going to happen next. I am working as an architect, and I am renovating old buildings. There's always that hunger for this kind of thing. And, you know, I'm on Facebook. Somebody tells me that the Dracula Castle is for sale. Well, that that could be an interesting project. So I don't know what's going to come out. I don't have enough money for that. I think it's quite a bit. But that could
they
be
didn't even set
know,
a
something
price.
Like that. Could, yeah, and that could be something that I'm doing in the future. So I don't know. I've done one film and this hotel as far as bed and breakfast goes, but I'm not sure. I'll let you know when it happens. But I do have the hunger.
Okay, Speaking of the film, this is really important. We got to tell people where they can find it. It is definitely on DVD. That's how I saw it, but it's also in digital form. I know it's on Hulu. Why don't we tell people how they can find the film and how they can find you? Because I have zero doubt we have raised interest from many corners.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the film is DVD on Amazon. You can buy it various places in DVD format. Hulu is carrying it in the free version and the Hulu Plus. And so it depends on if you like to watch commercials or not. But that's probably the easiest place to get it on demand. If you have questions or you want to see the place for yourself, the Bed and Breakfast Hotel is called the Patterson in Denver. And, you know, I can be reached through that website. That's probably the best way. If people want to come see it during the day, we can offer a tour or two. If you want to spend the night, you know, that's definitely an option too. So I'd say thepattersoninn.com is the hotel's website.
And, Brian, that's what I was going to ask.
Go ahead.
People are probably interested in and knowing what's happening. Now the film was filmed a couple years ago, and now the inn has been renovated, and it is open for business, as you said, under the name The Patterson Inn. And if you go to the website, if you watch the movie and then go to the website, the Patterson Inn website, you can see the amazing transformation that the inside of this building has made. It is absolutely beautiful. It is gorgeous. I was wondering if now that it is open for the public and you do have people coming in there, I'm sure you have lots of ghost hunters and paranormal investigators coming in, as well as historians. Are they able to do any sort of ghost hunting there? Do you have any sort of ghost walk or historic program that deals with the paranormal aspects of this as a business, or is it just kind of come and stay and see what happens?
There's been a few ghost investigation groups, paranormal investigation groups that would like to get in there and do these things. What we do is, you know, we provide an overnight stay for guests. During the month of October, I tend to do some tours and some storytelling, but most of the year it is a functioning bed and breakfast that, you know, you can go and experience for yourself. So the only problem that we have with combining investigation groups and guests are, you know, the wee hours in the morning and the noise that occurs. So we tend to try to limit it to, you know, the specified times that we do these things. But if there's a large enough interest, then, yeah, we'll definitely do some tours and groups through there.
Ooh, I think there will be.
There might be.
As the word continues to spread, because people do find out about these things, and you're within, a very, very loud shout anyway, distance from the Stanley. You know, you're in the same state anyway. So
sure.
A lot of people head out that way, you know, and it sounds like your place would be, you know, a great side trip for people who are heading over to the Stanley, or people who haven't seen Denver itself before, which is a fascinating city. Yeah, I forgot. That was a good point you made a lot earlier about how young a city really it is. You know, it was kind of the capital of the Wild West until you got all the way to the coast, probably to San Francisco. But, you know, even that, just it's the history isn't that long.
No, it really isn't. And so everything's documented. You know, when you're talking, the longer the history goes, the many hundreds of years, it tends to transform quite a bit, but there's still living people that have owned the house in, you know, the late 70s where all this stuff was occurring. And if you hear it from the guy himself, it's a pretty good reflection of what happened. I appreciate it. I would say that if anybody has interest, you know, go check it out. It's quite an interesting place. The Stanley I've not been to, but I've been by there, and, you know, I know the history. I think that movie turned it into a different place, the scripted movie. I would say that the Castle Project and the Patterson Inn are unscripted, And, you know, I didn't even have any actors. I don't know any actors. I just shoot what was occurring. So that's kind of the difference, but I think it's an interesting place to visit for sure.
There's
yeah,
a place
I'm
that
seeing
we
the site
the
myself,
Lens.
And it's great. Go ahead.
No, it's all right. Go ahead.
No, that's it. I was just saying I'm looking at the site right now, and, yeah, it is. You're right. Teresa's right. It's an amazing transformation from the kind of poor, beleaguered, yet still majestic building that you inherited, and you've transformed it into what looks like a very elite, fun, interesting, refined kind of place. How many rooms? How many people can stay at a time?
There used to be 30 rooms in the house, and we transformed it to 7 suites with bathrooms, and there's 1 2-bedroom. So the rooms are large. It's like when you go there, you have your own section of the house, and it's very comfortable. And I have my own favorite room. You got to check out the Prague room. It's like out of the Harry Potter films. It's a 30-foot tall cathedral ceiling with Gothic decor, and I picked everything out personally. It's my favorite.
Teresa, you were mentioning, I heard the word the Lemp. What were you going to say about the Lemp, which is a fascinating place and one of America's most haunted?
I was going to say that there is a place that we covered in our book called the Lemp Mansion, which is very similar. It was a large single-family home by a brewery mogul that lived in St. Louis, and he had this gorgeous house, and his family lived there for quite a while. Eventually, it changed hands several times, and it is now a bed and breakfast, and they have 6 suites. I love the Lemp Mansion, don't get me wrong, but it's nowhere near as elegant as the Patterson Inn looks online. I've stayed at the Lemp, and I absolutely loved it. I have nothing negative to say about it. But the Patterson looks a lot more elegant and refined. It's beautiful. But they have found a way to balance that, their hauntings and their business as a bed and breakfast. And it's year-round. It's not just in October. So, I don't know. It's just something to think about. I know that all my paranormal people, all my ghost hunters and parahistorians, that the crowd that I run with, these are the kind of places that we like, especially places with such interesting history. So I wish you luck. I'm sure that you'd have no problem getting people to stay in the bed and breakfast because it is gorgeous. But the history itself is so interesting, and to bring in the paranormal angle, I mean, I work with historic preservation. We save places from being torn down because we find a paranormal angle to get the interest in. Luckily, this place had you and your partner, so it didn't get torn down. It didn't get turned into a parking lot or a quickie mart or whatever, and you've done a beautiful job of it. So I applaud you, and I hope to get out there someday. This looks like it would be perfect for our next book.
Well, thank you, and I would offer come on out and see for yourself, and we'll take care of you. It's one of a kind, that's for sure.
And the room,
yeah, that's a great point.
Gorgeous.
Great point Teresa made as she was enumerating the similarities. It is actually rather remarkable. So if you're not familiar with the Lemp, that really is actually a very good idea. You should. You know, just check them out, check out their website, poke around a little bit and see how they kind of juggle all of these various activities and do seem to make it all work, if that's something you're interested in. One question that just came to mind I was meaning to ask earlier, from a relatively documented standpoint, kind of putting aside the most wild of the rumors and legends, how many deaths would you guess or approximate have occurred in the house or in the building?
I can confirm a few, but I don't know. You know, it was an apartment building for 30 years, and it's, you know, there's no way to confirm that. But the one from 1948. Tulin Sudan was documented, and her death certificate says indeed that that's what happened. If you go before that, Senator Patterson passed away in the House, and his wife Catherine passed away in the House. So, you know, there's three just from, you know, scratching the surface. That's something that that's very hard to find because people don't like to talk about that. But more than a few, I would say.
Well, and you mentioned all those children who only one of whom lived to adulthood. I mean, I assume at least some of them were home.
We could, in fact, draw those conclusions. I know that James Patterson was in L.A., I believe, at the time. But and then, you know, various people were traveling. But, yeah, you know, there's the evidence leads you to believe that something like that would happen for various people. It's just tough to certify it. And so I'm, you know, I like to talk about the folklore, but if it's a fact, then I can confirm that. And that's kind of how I lead the documentary, and that's what I believe to do.
All right, now, we've put this off for 55 minutes, and a very swift and fascinating 55 minutes. I don't want to give away too much, but I will leave it in your capable hands. What aspect of your final theory about the place are you comfortable in revealing here? Because, man, I think we got people hooked. I don't think we're going to lose anyone if we give a little bit of a hint there. Because I think both Teresa and I thought that was a fascinating wrinkle that you came up with.
Well, I don't want to run anybody off because that's not my point. But, you know, I can comfortably say that everything in the last 15 minutes of the film is true. You know, as far as the evidence that I'm finding in the architecture of the building, because I look at these things, I'm studying buildings left and right. You know, there's, if you look at the top of this, at the top of the building, you'll see these little forged rabbits going up the hips. And so there's these strange symbols throughout the whole building. I found what was a Ichthus wheel, which is it's a symbol from the time of Christ that was cast into the carriage house floor. So there's, you know, there's so many of these weird things that all lead and tell the story. I think buildings tell the story of the time, and art tells the story of the time. And so when you pay attention to it, you can experience what was happening at the time and put it all together, and that's how the movie might leave you.
Well done. Yeah, it's really interesting. I've always been extremely interested in symbols. What's the term? Is it semiotics? Is that the study of symbols? I think it is. And their meaning. And, you know, in our day and age, it's kind of one of the things that's kind of been lost, not completely, of course, but if you go back in time, the further back you go, it seems, the more and more important symbols were and the layers of symbols and what they represented. And, of course, yes, absolutely, in artwork, most of all. I mean, those the Renaissance, the Middle Age, and even earlier artists were absolutely steeped in the symbology of their religion, if we're talking about Europe, of Christianity. And so it is just rife. Everything is rife with multiple meanings. And that's kind of something we've lost, I think, a little bit. We're much more literal, I think, these days, because there's just so much information. There's a vast amount of information out there, but it's all or mostly kind of thin. Whereas in the past, the distant past, there was a lot less information, but it was also very, very thick and meaningful. And in your own, you know, without trying to freight things down too much, in your own way, you've kind of returned, you've made that connection, and I think it holds a lot of meaning, and it's food for thought, you know, even if ultimately we can't prove, for example, conclusions. There's no disputing the fact that this evidence exists and you found these things. I mean, clearly it's there. It's a part of the building, but or the buildings. But the fact that you come up with a really interesting, fascinating theory about those symbols, that part probably, you know, can't really be proved. But the simple fact is that you have raised these questions and put that thought in people's mind. I think, like I said, that's a service, because I think we're just so shallow and literal in our interpretations of things, just because there's just too much information to bother with spending a whole lot of time trying to parse the hidden meaning of things. That's probably why novels remain important and will for the foreseeable future, because that is one format where you really can still achieve multiple meanings, and metaphor is so important, and so on and so forth. So I wanted to applaud you for that, because I think that's a, you know, the events are repeatable. I mean, these things do happen in the broadest sense anyway. If you abstract out your experience, these kinds of things happen. But I think you did something unique with it and took it to a different place. So I applaud you for that.
Well, thank you. I'm interested in symbols and architecture, and because they're engraved into the architecture in our day and age now, you know, everything's coming at us from our cell phone every 2 minutes, 2 seconds sometimes. And it doesn't let your mind really get focused on some, and on observing. Everything's coming to you. You don't have to go anywhere to see anything. And, you know, when I travel and I look at architecture in Europe specifically, you know, you're going through and you're walking the streets as they were 500 years ago, because all the buildings were there 500 years ago. And I think if you look a little deeper, stories are told with symbols before, and art, because we didn't have cameras and social media. So I think it's fascinating. I'm holding a book that I had to do research with, the history and practice of magic, and I think it might, it's got a lot of symbols and how all these things tie together. It might interest some of your listeners.
Oh,
Paul Christian,
I'm certain.
So.
I am certain that it would. And I don't mean to imply that there's a lack of symbols in the modern world. There's plenty of places. It's just not quite as prevalent, and it's not probably quite as necessary as it used to be to think about it. So, yeah, those are great points. And even when you go, you know, to the oldest parts of at least European America, I mean, you're still only going back not even 500 years. You know, for the most part, really, it's 400 is pretty much the max, and Europe's thousands of years, certainly in some cases. So yeah, it's a much older world, at least in terms of the white man, as they say. All right, well, fantastic. Really enjoyed talking with you. Really enjoyed the film. I very, very highly recommend it. I really do. If you're interested in taking things as broadly as possible, first, if you're simply interested in a good, well done, well put together, thoughtful, compelling documentary on any subject, this is that. If you are interested in history and architecture, this is that. If you are interested in the paranormal, there's all kinds of that. So there are many angles from which to appreciate the Castle Project, and I really do recommend it very highly to anyone with any of those interests. What do you think, Teresa?
Absolutely. I think it's great. I got hooked on the history, and the hauntings kept me there. I thought it was great, and I'd love to do some more research and eventually make my way out there. Maybe we can head to the Stanley. Thank you so much for joining us. This place is amazing. Everybody look it up online. Look up the Castle Project, and let us know what you think.
Well, thank you, Teresa and Eric, and yeah, I will definitely show you the place if you can get out here.
Oh, we're coming.
Love to. Absolutely looking forward to it. Hey, want to let everyone know we are booked for weeks and weeks and weeks. I'm trying to squeeze in this special project, but we just don't have any room for like 6 weeks. Next week, we are covering the huge UFO conference that will be going on later that week. Very, very special, very well-known high-end UFO-type guests, so that will be amazing. We are here every single Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, and, of course, you can find us on Twitter, @AMHaunted. Find us on Facebook, AMHaunted. You can find us online. Our website is americas-most-haunted.com. And as we mentioned in passing, we haven't talked about it a whole lot lately, but I'm sure we will be doing more and more as the weeks go by. But the America's Most Haunted book, which is a detailed and very hopefully readable look at the 10 most haunted public or semi-public locations in the U.S., our book, and that's coming out at the end of September. So that is getting to be closer. We're already working on all kinds of PR and promo and marketing stuff. So that is starting to get very, very exciting. It's starting to feel real, my friends. In fact, you can read an excerpt of the book, a little snippet. We'll be doing more of those too. But there's a little snippet that's available on the America's Most Haunted website. Just click on the picture of the book on the up at the top there where all the images are. So thanks again. One more time. We were very, very excited to have Brian Higgins with us, director of the award-winning haunting documentary, The Castle Project. Have a great week and great evening, everyone. We'll talk to you very soon. Thank you very much.